Okay, folks, if we can reconvene so we can stay on time. So, Mr. Robertson, would you please introduce item 16?
Thank you, Chair Wolf, and I want to say congratulations to you and to Dr. Hunter for new terms as Chair and Vice Chair.
Thank you.
Item 16 is an information item and requires no board action. In January 2016, the State Water Board's Office of Enforcement staff provided us an update on efforts to understand the scope and strategies to regulate discharges from cannabis farming operations, both in the Central Coast and statewide. Existing cannabis regulatory efforts in the North Coast and Central Valley regions are now being expanded statewide. And to start building capacity in this region, we have received two positions to deal with this new workload. And in a minute, Harvey Packard, Sector Manager Harvey Packard, will introduce one of those new staff. Additionally, the State Water Board Office of Enforcement staff, Heather Mapes, will provide an update on the new regulatory effort and the path forward. And then staff for both the Central Coast Water Board and the State Board will be available for questions. And with that, I'll introduce Harvey Packard.
Great. So,
Harvey Packard, Central Coast Water Board. I want to introduce Lou Lamoni.
So, Lou, come on up here. Stand up.
Lou joined us in December. She has a bachelor's degree in environmental engineering from Louisiana State University and a master's in natural resources and sustainable development from the American University in Washington, D.C. Her work experience includes stormwater planning and program management, BMP design and optimization, watershed planning, and water conservation. She spent 6 years working for the City of Washington, D.C.'s Department of Energy and the Environment, managing the design and installation of low-impact development stormwater BMPs, but was happy to relocate to West Coast where she could continue working in water resources management with Geosyntech Consultants, City of Santa Monica's Office of Sustainability, and most recently with the Coastal San Luis Resource Conservation District. So she has quite a resume, and we're very pleased to have her with us, and we welcome Leah with us. Well, first, as John mentioned, we'll hear from Heather Mapes of Office of Enforcement. We'll also hear from Aaron Mustaine of the Office of Enforcement, and also from Leah. So we'll turn the time over to Heather.
Good morning. My name is Heather Mace. I'm a staff attorney with the State Water Board Office of Enforcement. And I am going to provide an updated presentation on the Cannabis Regulation and Enforcement Program, also referred to as the CREW program. Since 2014, the Water Board's Cannabis Regulation and Enforcement Unit and the California Department of Fish and Wildlife's Watershed Enforcement Team have partnered to reduce the adverse impacts of cannabis cultivation on water quality, fish and wildlife, and to fulfill the legislative task of expanding the pilot project statewide. In November 2016, California voters approved Proposition 64, also known as the Adult Use of Marijuana Act, which legalized recreational cannabis use for individuals over the age of 21. It is now legal to personally cultivate up to 6 plants per residence. However, commercial cultivation is still limited to medical cannabis and must be under 1 acre. In 2018, Prop 64 will allow commercial cultivation of non-medical cannabis, and in 2023, the 1 acre restriction will no longer apply. The Water Board's authority under Prop 64 is similar to that under the Medical Cannabis Regulation and Safety Act. Prop 64 requires compliance with any requirement imposed to protect natural resources, including but not limited to protection of in-stream flow and water quality. prior to an applicant being granted a license. Therefore, commercial cannabis cultivators will be required to obtain coverage under the statewide WDR prior to receiving a state license to cultivate. Furthermore, Prop 64 specifically requires that cultivation be conducted in accordance with state and local laws relating to land conversion, grading, electricity use, and that CDFW, the state water boards, regional water boards, and law enforcement shall address environmental impacts of cultivation and shall coordinate with local and county law enforcement when doing their enforcement efforts. As such, the CREW program strategies that have been developed for medical cannabis cultivation sites will likewise apply to recreational cultivation sites. Whether an individual is cultivating for medical or recreational purposes, any individual who discharges or proposes to discharge waste that could affect the quality of waters of the state, or who discharges or proposes to discharge a pollutant or dredge and fill material into waters of the United States, has a legal obligation to file a report of discharge with a regional board unless they waive that requirement. After receiving the report of discharge, a board has the duty to ensure that the discharge complies with the water quality control plan and will not result in pollution or nuisance. These requirements apply to discharges from cannabis cultivation, given the extensive evidence that these discharges can and do impact the quality of waters of the state and United States. This slide lists some of the common threats to water quality that we've seen at cannabis cultivation sites. The top two photos demonstrate improper storage and dumping of chemicals and garbage and human waste. The bottom three left photographs demonstrate unauthorized grading, excavation, and deforestation that we have observed. And the middle and lower right photograph demonstrate unauthorized water storage and diversion. As you might recall from last year's presentation, the CREW program is comprised of four strategies, those being multi-agency coordination, regulation, enforcement, and outreach and education. I'm going to go through some of the updates that have occurred in those program strategies since our last discussion. The multi-agency coordination involves the State Water Board, the Regional Water Boards, CDFW, County Law Enforcement, among others. In the initial task force area, the State Water Board partnered with the North Coast Regional Board, the Central Valley Regional Board, the Division of Water Rights, and local law enforcement agency to jointly prioritize their enforcement and regulatory efforts. This collaboration has included conducting joint inspections at priority watersheds. The collaboration with local government, tribes, and law enforcement has been essential to the success of the program. We have seen counties conduct regular inspections to determine compliance with local ordinances and to investigate citizen complaints. The members of the multi-agency coordination then have met and prioritized the most egregious complaints and done joint inspections. Because the CREW program is expanding statewide, the number of positions have also grown since we last spoke to this board. We have grown from 11 initial positions to 23 positions, two of which have been allocated to the Central Coast region. The second program strategy is regulation. Both the North Coast Water Board and the Central Valley Water Board have adopted waste discharge regulatory programs relating to cannabis cultivation. The North Coast region has over 800 enrollees, and the Region 5 program has over 1,400 enrolled in their program. And both of those regions have a backlog of applications that are also waiting to be processed. The State Water Board Division of Water Quality is also tasked with development of a statewide general waste discharge requirement for cannabis cultivation. DWQ is currently planning on bringing a proposed order to the State Water Board by January 1st, 2018. They are hoping to release a draft for a public comment sometime around June of this year prior to taking it to the State Board for consideration. And in terms of enforcement, although this region does not have a specific waiver or general order for waste discharge requirements for cannabis cultivators, the region can utilize other enforcement tools until the statewide order is adopted. These actions may be brought under the Clean Water Act, the Central Coast Basin Plan, and the Port of Cologne Act. Since the CREW program began in 2014, the water boards have participated in over 200 joint inspections in over six counties. These inspections have documented many water rights, water quality, and fish and game code violations. We have also seen an increase in voluntary compliance, and when voluntary compliance was not obtained, we pursued formal enforcement, and this slide lists some of our enforcement options. So we have sent notice of violation letters, 13267 investigative orders requesting information, cleanup and abatement orders, as well as administrative civil liability complaints. Education and outreach is also an important component of the program in terms of bringing the cultivation industry into this new regulatory program. All of the entities involved in the multi-coordination agencies have an active and community outreach events to provide information on this new program. The State Water Board has taken the lead on developing written outreach materials to distribute to the potentially regulated industry members. I do have copies of some of those flyers and brochures if anyone is interested in seeing them. The State Water Board has also delivered several presentations to various audiences, including county and regional board meetings, similar to what we're doing today. And moving forward, we aim to expand the program statewide, as I previously mentioned, and we're going to continue our inspection, outreach, and coordination efforts that we've been doing up to now. Another step that is being taken is the development of interim principles and guidelines to address water supply issues, and that's being taken by the Division of Water Rights. The water boards have an obligation to ensure that the individual or cumulative effects of water diversion or discharges associated with cannabis cultivation do not affect the in-stream flows needed for fish spawning, migration, and rearing, and flows needed to maintain natural flow variability. To accomplish this goal, the division has worked in consultation with CDFW to develop regulations to protect springs, wetlands, and aquatic habitat in areas of the state that are or that have the potential, or cultivation has the potential to impact those flow requirements. The division is currently targeting fall of this year to release the interim principle and guidelines for priority regions and watersheds. Regulations for additional regions or watersheds will follow thereafter as needed. These principles and guidelines are going to set the stage for the small irrigation use registration program that the division is also working on by establishing those in-stream flow requirements that cultivators will be required to meet. The current small domestic use program does not cover commercial cannabis cultivation, and application to individual cultivation is determined on a case-by-case basis. A significant number of commercial cannabis cultivators are going to need to develop storage to meet those in-stream flow requirements, And currently there's no program in place to handle the permitting of those storage projects. In the North Coast, it's particularly expected that cultivators are going to need to rely on tanks or bladders to meet their water needs. That might be less of an issue here, where my understanding is a lot of cultivators are going to be relying on groundwater. But where there is a need for water storage, the Small Irrigation Use Registration Program will apply. The current general conditions for this program are so far only established for the North Coast region. Under those general conditions, the storage amount must be 20 acre feet per year or less. And there are use restrictions, the primary uses being for irrigation, heat control, or frost protection. And the small domestic use registration can be combined with the small irrigation registration, but that 20 acre per feet per year limitation will still apply. Prior to adopting the interim principles and guidelines, the Water Board will allow for public comment, which they are aiming to do sometime between March and May of this year. The State Water Board may update the interim principles and guidelines pending adoption of long-term regulations. And the State Water Board also has primary enforcement responsibility for these principles and guidelines. At this time, I'm going to welcome Aaron up to talk about our cannabis prioritization identification system.
All right, good morning. It's nice to see you all again. I'm going to talk about the Cannabis Identification and Prioritization System. We call it CIPS for short. It is an online GIS application that the Water Boards contracted to develop. We had input from our North Coast Regional Board staff, Central Valley staff, DIT, our Division of Information Technology, Office of Enforcement, staff as well. And we worked with our contractor to develop a system whose purpose was to determine the scope of the problem utilizing a watershed approach. The system uses an algorithm to identify greenhouses and cannabis canopy, and it draws polygons around those. We do own the system. I'll go into more detail, but we do not own that particular algorithm. And additionally, there was a development of a model that allows us to prioritize sites within what's been mapped. So it'll look at things like proximity to surface water, water use, existence of threatened and endangered species, and then staff can run that model and prioritize sites within a watershed that we do own. So of the 164 small watersheds that we mapped, we identified over 19,000 cultivation sites. Again, these are outdoor cultivation sites in Northern California. The contractor allowed us to have a limited amount of surface area to map. In addition to the algorithm that was run, they did do data quality. Went back and massaged the data to eliminate errors. This basically amounted to 12% of Region 1 being mapped and 5% of the entire Central Valley. So not just the northern part, but the entire Central Valley has been mapped. Region 1, in order to get as much as they could out of the limited geographical area that was mapped, looked for watersheds that didn't have a lot of public land. So they focused on the atoll and places that are privately owned within our scope of our program. And then the photo shows one of the base maps that has the CDFW database information, and on the right-hand side is scrolling down. It's hard to see, but the canopy is highlighted by red polygons. So that's what we, when we're using the system after we've logged in, we can zoom in and actually look at the NAEPS imagery and have those canopies and greenhouses identified. Okay. So as I said, we do own the application. It is deployed onto one of our servers, under one of the water board servers. Anyone with a CWIX, the California Integrated Water Quality System, database account can request access, including the division staff, because as you know, eRIMS is also tied to CWIX. So the thing that's, to me, is exciting is I can contact my colleague in water rights. We're going out and doing the same inspection, and we can actually see the same map with the same details. Whereas for those of us who use ArcGIS on our desktop, were I to try and share my files with Leah, I'd have to create a geodatabase and transport all that information to her for her to be able to see the same thing I'm seeing. Now, if she wants to see what I'm seeing, she just logs in. Also, as you can see, the title of this slide is editing. There are three rules that SIPS allows: the viewer, the modeler, and the editor. So the viewer cannot touch the database, they can't add anything, and they cannot run the model. The modeler can go in and say, I want to, the proximity of the surface water is incredibly important to me, I want to give it a high priority, and I'm going to run my model and see what results come up. The editor, for those of us who are GIS savvy and part of the cannabis program, we can actually go in and draw our own polygons. And so this is where it's really powerful. This was why we wanted to own the system. So now, if I map a watershed, I can upload some of that information. Additionally, if we go out and do an inspection, things are a bit different. We can collect that data in the field and upload it into the system. And this slide shows the entire mapped area. So that's Northern California, and you can kind of see the coastline. And what it shows you is the heat maps. So there's hot spots. The red marks are the concentrated areas of cannabis. So if I was zeroing in on the top near the Klamath, I could basically drill down and get into those clusters and see what is going on in each watershed. It also has a dashboard on the top. Again, this is the entire California, so it shows all 19,000 plus grows. And once you zoom in, the dashboard on the top will change. If you change your criteria, the dashboard changes. I did want to mention there are additional base layers that our staff can select depending on what they want to look at. And we can add new imagery as it becomes available. So right now we have it still pointing to the 2014 NAEP imagery, but we are able to update it for the 2016 NAEP imagery. So, and I'm gonna turn it over to Leah and am available for comments after.
Thank you. I'm gonna provide a bit of an overview cannabis cultivation in Region 3 specifically, including which counties have adopted ordinances and estimates of the number of commercial cultivators by county and approximate locations. So, the county and land use ordinances in Region 3 are summarized here. But this is a condensed version of the matrix that was in the staff report and is also on the website. All eight counties have passed ordinances or moratoriums, and most of this within the last year, or year and a half. They establish or clarify regulations for medical cannabis cultivation. So Santa Cruz, Monterey, San Luis Obispo, and Santa Barbara, in the second column from the left there, all allow commercial cultivation. Santa Clara, San Mateo, and San Benito do not allow commercial cultivation. All counties have an exception for personal use, so up to 6 plants can be grown indoors. And 5 counties have moratoriums, so Santa Cruz, San Luis Obispo, Santa Barbara, San Mateo, and San Benito are peplus moratorium in some form. So Santa Cruz actually specifically calls out non-medical use, cultivation, and possession. San Luis Obispo and Santa Barbara, their moratorium says no new sites, but they have allowed an exemption for existing sites. San Mateo's ban is all outdoor cultivation. So just about all the counties I've heard from their planning departments are going to be revisiting these temporary moratoriums in the next year to specifically adjust Prop 64. So I'm going to go into a bit more detail per county and kind of get into the numbers a little bit. Okay, so Santa Cruz, their ordinance is proposed. It is expected to be adopted in October of this year after completion of the EIR process. They had 951 growers register who are interested in applying for licensure to be a medical grower. So I should backtrack a little bit. All of the ordinances that are in place only deal with medical cultivation. The moratoriums were in place as sort of a temporary measure to deal with non-medical cultivation, but after this year and whenever they revisit those permanent ordinances, that I think they're going to be really getting into medical versus non-medical. But we expect general trends to be the same. So for our counties that are allowing commercial cultivation of medical cannabis, we think that they'll likely permit commercial cultivation of non-medical as well. So the 951 growers, that information has been taken in by the county. They're currently putting it into a database, which is going to be geo-referenced, so we'll get an idea of geographical trends of their distribution. This data is not available yet, and the county planners didn't really have any estimates in advance of that. They couldn't really tell me where in the county they think some of those grows are. But we should know soon, hopefully the beginning of February. But the EIR lists these land uses, commercial ag, residential ag, industrial timber, and special use as proposed in their ordinance. So that's subject to change. Some of those may be weeded out as the environmental review moves forward. Monterey will also be pretty active in terms of medical cannabis cultivation. They are actually the only county that's currently accepting permits. They've received 6. They started accepting applications last month. They estimate that there may be another 200 growers out there, although the California Department of Food and Ag issued a survey last June to growers statewide asking 2 questions. Will you be applying for a cannabis cultivation permit, and in what county? And they got 455 responses in Monterey County alone. So we think the 200 number may be on the low end. They're only going to be permitting, they only permit indoor cultivation on farmland within an existing structure or on industrial parcels. So it's kind of a big caveat. They've noticed concentrations of grows around Salinas Valley on the east side of the Los Padres Forest, and then the southern end of the county near Slow Border. So San Luis Obispo, their moratorium is in effect. They're allowing existing sites to continue. They have had 431 growers register. 278 of those are in the California Valley. They think there may be another 800 to 1,000 existing around the county. So maybe in the California Valley, maybe more in the South County, maybe elsewhere. We don't know yet the number of licenses they plan to issue, what types of land uses they plan to permit, and the size of grows they'll permit. I've heard from their planning department that they expect to have a draft ordinance out for public review at the end of February, so we'll know soon. Santa Barbara, what they have done actually kind of looks a lot like San Luis Obispo, the temporary moratorium for on the cultivation, but with the caveat that they're still allowing the existing sites to continue. Their county board of supervisors did not recommend a registry, so they don't really have any official numbers, but the CDFA survey had 336 girls respond from Santa Barbara. So it gives us kind of an idea. The code enforcement office has told me that most of the girls that they're seeing is in, they're in Carpinteria, Lompoc, Santa Maria, and then along the San Marcos Pass, so the Highway 154 corridor. San Benito is kind of an outlier. They have the moratorium in place, no new cultivation, but they're also allowing an exemption for existing sites, but there are only 32 of these. And no one in the county, no growers responded to the CDFA survey. So we don't think it's going to be a heavy hitter in terms of commercial cultivation. Their Board of Supervisors is revisiting their moratorium this year as well, so that could change. Their county planners told me that there's an acknowledgement that there could be some economic incentives for the county to go ahead and permit commercial cultivation, so that may change over. Most of these sites are along the Pacheco River, so sort of in the southeast side of the county there. Santa Clara, San Mateo, and Ventura only overlap, well, San Benito only overlaps into Region 3, partly, but most of the county is in the region, so I included it here. The next three counties, Santa Clara, San Mateo, and Ventura, really only overlap with Region 3 jurisdictional area for a small percentage. And their planning departments didn't have great estimates, so I really only have the CDFA numbers to go off of here, and we don't know what percentage of them are in the Region 3 area, so this data is a little less useful. But in Santa Clara, they had 201 respondents to the survey, and their sheriff's department has conducted 172 inspections related to cannabis specifically, and then most of those, or some of those, are in the Santa Cruz Mountains, which may sort of come into our area. San Mateo is 118, and then in Ventura, 417, but we're not sure how much of those are actually in Region 3. One note about Ventura is that it was recommended to their board last December, so a month ago. A proposed ordinance was presented that would permit up to 100,000 square feet of cultivation. So their current ban on commercial cultivation is also being revisited, so that may change soon. So just to recap, number of growers that we absolutely definitely know of that have either applied for licenses or have registered with their counties is just under 1,400, so 1,388. If we combine that number plus all of the growers that, the estimated growers that didn't register, or counties that didn't have registries to begin with, the number looks a little different. So roughly 25 to 2,800 if you include all those other sites. I used a range for Monterey because the 200 number given to me by the county and the 455 number from the CDFA survey, pretty big difference. So I just wanted to sort of try and capture that as much as possible. So in sum, I think Santa Cruz is likely to be one of the most, if not the most active in terms of cultivators, commercial cultivators. Monterey also active, but they're only going to be permitting indoor grows, so it's just something to keep in mind just in terms of a regulatory perspective. San Luis Obispo and Santa Barbara, both do have large numbers of commercial cultivators. They've not yet seen draft permanent ordinances, so we don't know how many licenses they'll be issuing, what types of land uses they'll be permitted on, and the max size. So we should know soon this spring. And then these other four counties, Ventura, San Benito, Santa Clara, San Mateo, currently no commercial cultivation, likely to change soon. So we're keeping a close eye, working closely with their county planners, and going to be commenting on these ordinances as they come out. So the next steps, Region 3 continues to work with Office of Enforcement to establish an enforcement program, reach out to the local agencies to get enforcement protocols set up, and then get the groundwork laid to implement the order once it's available. So, questions?
Mr. Johnson?
Yes, I have a couple of questions. In terms of the, I see that Monterey is only permitting indoor grows, and I'm assuming that those will potentially be either indoor grows in greenhouses with a permeable floor or indoor grows in greenhouses with an impermeable floor. I would like to hear a little bit our thoughts on what our regulatory approach is going to be to that.
Hello. So I'm going to go ahead and answer that because I'm probably the best suited. So at this time, we are currently regulating greenhouses with permeable floors in both the North Coast region and the Central Valley. We would not consider those indoor grows. They do require grading, so they typically have a larger impact to surface waters, as there's set, you know, the spoils from the grading activities, the loose soils where they haven't compacted. And so grading activities are really one of the big focuses of both the WDRs in Central Valley and the waiver in the North Coast.
That's in the construction of the greenhouse.
We regulate, yes, that is true. However, the materials that you use to construct, I mean, that's all included in the order. So what, how you dispose of your spoils is in the order itself. And the development of those sites is a big part of continued cultivation, because what we find is that they cultivate and they don't, I mean, they grade and cultivate and they don't, they aren't cleaning up after themselves.
And I would expect that some portion of the Monterey industry is going to end up repurposing cut flower greenhouses as that industry has kind of taken a hit due to import competition. So that wouldn't involve construction. So in terms of regulation of just ongoing operation of those?
Over-irrigation could be a problem as well from those types of sites. Again, sediment will be an issue because if you have permeable floors, you also are going to have sediment runoff from those greenhouses. I don't see it as much as a problem. I have seen some over-irrigation out of greenhouses, but it's not as big of a problem as with the development of the sites itself. So that's probably positive for that region. As far as the indoor, completely indoor grows, where they have, you know, ventilation, dehumidification, where they're completely enclosed, that's where we're going to see wastewater being generated. And so then our goal is, or right now the question is, where is the wastewater being disposed of? And so what I, because we don't really have that program, we don't have a permit covering that program, I'm using outreach to get the message out that if you are discharging to a sanitary system, and I'll tell people, you know, that your toilet, that they need to have a use permit with their local agency, if the local agency will even grant them a use permit. And if they discharge to land or surface water, even if they treat that, they are going to have to get a permit with the water boards. And then lastly, that there are recirculation systems that they could potentially go to zero discharge, and that they're going to have some maintenance and dispose of something. So, however, I mean, there are vessels that you can obtain where the manufacturer will take, will clear them out for you. So there's different options, and I put them out there. Our state board staff in the Division of Water Quality has been directed by our executive management to investigate pre-treatment as part of the statewide cannabis order. So that's kind of to be continued. This was discussed a couple weeks ago, so they were probably a little blindsided. So I don't know if that will, but I'm assuming you will see some language in the June version, or the one that goes out for public comment.
So both in terms of greenhouses with permeable floors and in terms of outdoor irrigated grows in general, obviously we're already regulating general commercial greenhouses with permeable floors, and we're regulating irrigated agriculture. I'm curious how those two things are going to overlap. I'm assuming we're not going to ask people to get to get two permits for the same operation, but there's certainly a relationship.
I believe that they would have to get two permits. Cannabis is not federally recognized as a agricultural commodity by the federal government. They will not be able to use pesticides that are prohibited by the Department of Pesticide Regulation. They have not registered any pesticide that falls under the FIFRA regulation for use on cannabis, and they've been very hesitant to do so. I do understand that the MCRSA has asked them to look at some of the low threat exemptions. So the Medical Cannabis Regulation and Safety Act, I don't know how they're shortening it. It was MRSA, but now they added a C in there, so I'm not really sure what the acronym is. So it has directed them to investigate doing risk assessments and potentially allowing the use of pesticides. I think that then they would look at that low threat exemption. But again, other states, if you look at other states, they're not doing that. In Oregon, Spinosa is not even allowed. So, I'm assuming that California, in other regards, as far as where CDPH is concerned, or Department of Public Health, they're really following along what the other states are doing as far as what pesticides we're looking at and how they're going to be tested. So I don't really see a big change on that regard. So that's going to be the largest difference, I think, between your irrigated ag community that's currently operating that and the federal exemption, ag exemption, whether that applies or not.
So when you say that they would have to get two permits, does that mean that if somebody were doing an outdoor grow, that they would both have to have an irrigated ag permit under our ag waiver? And a cannabis permit?
I apologize. I thought you meant if they were doing a multi-commodity grow. So that was what I was referring to. So if they were growing tomatoes, because I live in Dixon, where we change over every few months, you got to do different crop on your paddock. So if they were to do something like that, they would need to have multiple permits.
So the irrigated ag waiver that we have that regulates essentially pretty much all irrigated agriculture in the region, this would be a separate permit for cannabis, and they would not be required to get an irrigated ag permit, or do we know?
Unless they're growing in another commodity.
Okay.
So, but I anticipate that the cannabis will be more stringent.
This is Harvey Packard. So obviously that's one of the questions that is a big question for us here in Region 3 still about the state boards program. I've talked to Division of Water Quality people a little bit, and they're saying that they will include agricultural management practice requirements in this statewide order. And theoretically, that might cover these facilities, and we wouldn't have to enroll in the ag order. We'll have to look at that order and see if it's adequate for what we think is protective of water quality through these agricultural grows, even for cannabis. So the options are, we have a statewide order that adequately covers the agricultural practice part of cannabis growing, which would be, I think, really great if state board can do that. Another option would be to, if we don't think the order is adequate in that respect, we would have to enroll them in the ag order also. And the other option, which I don't think anybody likes, or I know state board doesn't like, is that we don't use the state board order and we revise our ag order to include cannabis. That potentially could be an option. It would require, obviously, modification of our ag waiver, which is not an easy thing, but I think it's on the table. So hopefully that addresses your question.
The statute does state that WDRs,
the regional boards or the state board will adopt waste discharge requirements for the
right. So I think that means that we could include those kinds of requirements in the ag order. There is a list in the Port of Cologne Act that we would require to include in the ag order.
It just my comment is it would it would sure seem we would want to avoid requiring people to get multiple permits for a single operation, if possible. And obviously, we want to be sufficiently protective.
One of the ideas that's also been, that has been bounced around is to incorporate some of the Division of Water Rights requirements in the statewide general permit that DWQ is working on.
Okay, and my final question, I would just like to hear from regional staff sort of how far along we are on really establishing communication with the cities and the counties, or coordination with the cities and the counties that are actually moving forward on this, which it sounds like is mostly Santa Barbara, Santa Cruz, Monterey.
This is Lou Moon. I can talk to that about that a little bit. I've spoken with people, county planners, code enforcement, sheriff's department, and in some cases, as Santa Barbara, their executive office, they call it. And in all the counties except for San Mateo, I haven't heard back from them. So I've been coordinating with planners to sort of get a calendar going of when their draft ordinances are expected to be out, and giving them some language on what environmental measures we would like to see. Code enforcement, I've asked to be invited on their inspections, so hopefully Santa Barbara is definitely the most active in terms of code enforcement of these sites, so I'm expecting to go on some inspections with them in the next couple weeks. So as far as the counties go, I think I definitely made the important context we need to make in starting the process of getting a protocol for inspections going. For the cities, I actually have a slide about that. Since there are only a handful of cities, Salinas, Greenfield, King City, and Watsonville, that I know of that are permitting commercial cultivation, I think the city of Monterey as well. That's sort of my next step, is to start reaching out to these cities and seeing how many growers they have and asking to be included, letting them know sort of an update on the order, how we're getting what we're planning in terms of enforcement, how we can coordinate with them. So it's in process.
Okay, because I know we had discussed in a more general sense, not specifically cannabis cultivation, trying to go county by county and really meet with a range of staff that we deal with, ranging from law enforcement to code enforcement to planning to just try and put ourselves in the loop a little more. So that we hear what's happening other than sort of tangentially.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, to the extent that we can really do that, I think that's helpful.
I agree. Sort of a task force for each county, something that I would hope to get going soon. So.
So I'll go from my left to my right. I believe that Mayor Delgado has questions also.
Yes, thank you. It was mentioned that there's kind of a standard for personal cultivation of allowing up to 6 plants. Is that correct? And yes, 6 mature budding plants is very different than 6 little seedlings. So does the 6 include all stages of growth?
It varies county to county. Some counties max out at 100 square feet for the personal use exemption. Some say just 6 plants. So it depends where you are.
Okay. And with Prop 64, is there a number like 6 or 12?
Six.
Six.
Mm-hmm.
And does Prop 64 differentiate between life stages?
No, just the number of plants.
Okay. How is it that Russian, Bulgarian, and Hmong were the languages besides Spanish that were used for some of the fact sheets and other outreach?
I'll answer that.
We actually did a survey in the Emerald Triangle and have reached out to those communities because those are communities that are cultivated in the Emerald Triangle. We're actually having next month a targeted outreach in Hmong, where we're going to provide interpreters to sit down with the Hmong community, which is active in the Trinity Pines area, which has hundreds of sites, and they will, we're actually going to have Hmong interpreters walk the permittees through the process of enrollment, so actually help them fill out those enrollments. So not only do we have outreach materials in Hmong, Bulgarian, Russian, and Spanish, but we also have our applications in those languages. Region 5 did not need Bulgarian. They have a large Spanish-speaking population, so we translated their notice of intent into Spanish. And so as languages come up, I've talked to some of the growers' organizations to let me know what languages. I had a request for Chinese from one person, so that's a possibility as well.
Okay. What's the definition of indoor cultivation? Is there one?
Yes, it is actually in the Medical Cannabis Regulatory and Safety Act, but I don't have that in front of me.
Is it sustainable? That's okay, you can tell us later.
It is codified.
Okay. What other crops, there's mushrooms, flowers, what other current crops are using indoor cultivation? Some examples. So flowers, mushrooms.
So right. So there is all variety of things: lettuce, tomatoes.
Okay.
And yeah, the hydroponic greenhouses.
Yeah, I was going to mention that. Some big greenhouses in Santa Maria with hydroponic.
Okay. Why is there the need for regulations specific to marijuana when it comes to indoor cultivation?
Right, that's a good question, and that's why we've contemplated just using the ag order as marijuana becomes another agricultural commodity.
Okay, and then the cultivation for medical cannabis, does it look different than cultivation for non-medical cannabis?
Not that I know of.
Because I heard it mentioned that the ordinances on the books now are for medical,
right?
And they'll have to modify themselves if they're going to be allowed for non-medical. So how does a grower grow for one and not the other?
Well, the reason that the ordinances are like that is because non-medical cultivation of all types was illegal until November, when Prop 64 was passed.
So how do you know it's a non-medical cultivation as opposed to a medical?
From looking at it as a...
No,
agricultural thing.
Or? How do we know that a grower is growing medical cannabis as opposed to the other?
Well, right now only medical is legal. So if it's not legally, it's not under the regulations of the current medical laws, then it's illegal, unless it's the 6 plants that are allowed personally.
So then, how do I grow medical? I mean, how am I acknowledged as growing for medical cannabis?
Well, the local agencies that have a program set up to permit it, you have to get a permit with those local agencies.
So is it a matter of who I'm selling to?
Those rules are established by Consumer Affairs. There's a new state board that actually covers the aspects of production and sale and that kind of stuff that we're not going to get involved.
Okay. I guess it's more of a curiosity than a water board issue. That's it. Thank you.
Mr. Young?
Thank you. So I'm trying to understand the regulatory framework for commercial growers and where we have hooks with permits and licenses. So I understand that everybody who's going to grow commercially is going to need a county business license, right? Just like any other business.
I believe so.
Okay.
So there's 2 state laws that apply. One is the Medical Cannabis Regulation and Safety Act, which is about a year and a half old now. The second one is Prop 64, which is only a couple months old. But any local agency can regulate this sale, and
so
any, like they can do any other.
Under the two California statutes,
mm-hmm.
do they require permits in and
yes.
of themselves?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
A state
permit? Permits for sale, for cultivation, for processing, for
delivery.
Distribution. Yeah. Transport.
Okay. And so this new agency is going to be the one that issues that permit?
Yeah.
Okay. And then there could be the additional permits of needing a WDR.
Exactly.
Or a water board if they're irrigating. And if they are, what, is there going to be any delineation as to whether someone says, well, I should really just get a waiver?
No, the water code sections were added by the Medical Cannabis Regulation Safety Act as a specific list of things that the water board has to include in its permits, but it doesn't say if it's a waiver or an order or what exact instrument it needs to be.
Okay, so if they're going to irrigate, they're going to need to get a WDR.
Regardless of irrigation, I don't think that's one of the criteria in the MCRSA.
Okay. So we'll have a hook on any commercial grower just through our own WDR.
Yes.
Okay.
Or the statewide
WDR. The statewide.
Yeah.
Will we have the ability to enforce a statewide
yes.
permit also mm-hmm. in
yeah.
addition to the WDR?
Well, the statewide permit will be the noise discharge requirement.
Okay, I meant from the two agencies.
No,
the agency implementing the permitting process through the two statutes.
There will be several agencies involved. We will have our own, the state board and the regional boards will have a permit. There's other permits for the other parts of the operation, the sale and the transportation and the processing.
Okay. And the notion of the registry, is that a requirement of any of the statutes that have been enacted, that a county has to have a registry of commercial growers?
No. That was just something the counties did to get an idea of what sort of volume they were dealing with and what size grows and locations they were dealing with.
Okay. So, and do we have an idea or an estimate of, if we looked at the overall cultivation going on, how much is, have we issued permits yet?
No.
So we have issued permits. So these are just people that have kind of voluntarily registered with counties.
Right, due to county licensing and permitting
yeah.
ordinances.
And so this, the permitting then isn't going to start till 2018. Was that what you said about the regulations needing to be?
Right. The statewide permitting regulation starts in 2018.
Okay. So that's when we're really going to start to have some idea.
Yeah. We have had a few growers contact us on their own and want to make sure they're in compliance with anything we do have. And basically we've told them we don't have a permit yet. You need to be in compliance with these types of management practices, the ones that are specified in the water code. And we said when we get a permit, we will be talking to you again.
And why shouldn't they have to enroll in the ag program?
We talked about that too. At this point, we've made the decision not to do that because there will be additional permits within the next 12 months. Hopefully it covers this. But so we haven't done that yet.
Well, so I'm going to say that we're collectively, as the state and regional boards, you can see from this discussion, we're trying to articulate a path forward on this. Should it be consistent with the existing ag order in this region? Should it be at the state water board level? You're watching the sausage making of how do we effectively regulate cannabis, you know, in the state and in the region. And I'm going to add in. The thought that we should also take the stakeholders into account here and what is the most likely pathway to assist them into getting into compliance, because ultimately that's what we want, compliance with requirements. And I would submit that a redundancy of orders isn't going to help that. A simplification strategy that's relatively simple with fewer necessary orders is probably a more effective way to achieve a higher level of compliance.
So I'm thinking about this interim period when you've got people approaching you wanting to know what they need to do. Do you send them a letter and say, by the way, there may not be a permit for you right now, but you must comply with these sections of the water code?
Yes, we do.
Okay.
So I'm going to add into that some of the discussion that staff have had with cannabis growers and commodity groups associated with cannabis growing. It is direction towards efforts to develop sustainable certification as well, and the value of sustainable certification for cannabis growers. That has value, we think, both for the marketplace, but also particularly for us and maybe how we regulate them.
That would just be for the cultivation of it.
It could be beyond that, but that's where we're focused. Yeah, in the water quality aspect of cultivation.
Yeah, I just thought about, you know, Bruce's comment earlier about the pesticides being used and having pesticide residue on marijuana leaves that people may be inhaling, ingesting. And I'm just kind of questioning thinking inside and outside how that kind of falls into being something that's kind of sustainable. I don't know.
It's complicated.
Not organic.
Yeah. It's complicated by the fact that pesticide use is governed by a federal statute. And none of this is legal according to any federal statutes.
Right. Okay. So, what are the permits going to be called that the new state agency is going to be issuing? Do they have a name for it yet?
I don't recall what it is.
Are you referring to the statewide WDR?
No. Under the Prop 64? Yes.
Their license is the statute.
Right. And what are they going to have a name for?
Not that I'm aware of.
So Lisa gives me some information here. There's a bureau called the Bureau of Medical Cannabis Regulation.
Okay.
They're going to set up, and it's under the Department of Consumer Affairs. They set up testing laboratories, requirements for dispensaries, requirements for distribution, requirements for transportation. And the cultivation, the lead agency is the Department of Food and Ag, and we fall under that part of it. And then there's also an Office of Medical Cannabis Safety under the Department of Public Health.
So is Food and Ag going to require a permit or license fee? They will be. Okay. All right. Great. Thank you, Mark.
There's a lead agency under CEQA for this program.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, my questions have to do with those communities, those jurisdictions that decide to impose a moratorium, not for the purposes of understanding the state law better and planning for it, but those jurisdictions that just don't want cannabis or to recognize cannabis cultivation in their communities, because as we know, it's happening, and there are efforts to sort of bring those operations to light, so to speak. So I heard the notion of a voluntary registry, which is just occurring in some counties, but is there any sort of planning at the state level or at the water board level? Because we won't even get those applications for discharge permits if they aren't permitted at the local level. But if there's opportunities to try to understand where identifying those sites, but also trying to understand what their cultivation practices include, because there are water quality impacts. And I think that for our purposes, it's really trying to understand what those impacts are and then readily planning and preparing how to respond to those impacts. So are there buffers in place, I guess, policies in place at the state level, something that you're sort of seeing out there in your educational and outreach efforts to try to get that information, even though there's the possibility of enforcement action at the same time for those that aren't getting permitted at the local level?
I'm going to go back to this slide. So I understand your question, you just want to sort of capture how the active sites that aren't going to be permitted are going to be dealt with. And Erin mentioned in the SIPs enforcement prioritization that there's actually an algorithm in there to identify grows, whether they're permitted or not. So that's new year, but that seems to me like that's a major vehicle for finding these sites. Also, the county, a lot of it will be complaint-based, so we get calls all the time. Counties get calls all the time. Some of them come to me. So we sort of, through those two avenues, we know what those growers are, where they are, and what they're doing. And whether or not it's an enforcement action or if they're enrolled and it's a compliance assistance, then I guess it's sort of case by case. But there will be ways that we reach out to those folks. And as far as the four counties that have no commercial cultivation at this point, two of them, Ventura and San Benito, probably will. So they'll be a little more active. San Mateo and Santa Clara are the sort of unknowns as far as if they're going to allow it or not.
So I'm going to use Shasta County as an example, even though it's not within your region. It's a red part of the state, and they're very conservative, and I don't know that they're going to move away from their moratorium. They don't want outdoor cultivation in their county. And so what it ends up being is entirely an enforcement program, and essentially a cleanup and abatement order program. So we go out and we do an investigation and determine, is there impacts to water quality? But there's no question that they cannot continue to cultivate and be under any sort of compliance with the state. They will not get a license. Not only will we not, enroll them, but neither will CDFA issue them a license for cultivation unless they're in compliance with their county ordinances. Does that answer your question? I don't know that they'll voluntarily comply because ultimately it is an enforcement action. Now, as far as outreach, whether or not they're in compliance with their local ordinances is not a question that I ever ask to a public audience. I just give them the tools that they need to comply. So, they could hypothetically take my information and try and not have water quality threats, but the county can come out at any time and rip out their plants. So.
And Mayor Delgado, you had a follow-up question?
You just said, was that a particular county didn't want outdoor cultivation. And it's my guess that most counties who don't want it from a philosophical basis or some other reason, they're not going to indoor or outdoor. Can you clarify if you meant indoor and outdoor?
So Butte County, it's just indoor only. So there are some counties that just, they don't want to see it.
Uh-huh.
So I don't understand the rationale, so I'm not going to try and comment on where it comes from.
Right. Less crime potential.
Yeah, potentially. I actually live in the city of Dixon. It's a farm community. They don't want it at all. They don't want anything to do with the cannabis industry. They don't want any dispensaries. And so it will be completely banned for all purposes. I don't even think they'll allow the 6-plant per patient. Yeah.
Okay. And with the Bureau of Medical Cannabis Regulation, I can't find a definition for indoor. Did you come up with the indoor definition?
I have. Actually, the one I have is not in, it's codified in the pending Santa Cruz ordinance, and it's a brilliant definition, but it's on my network drive, so I can't. Oh, you do? Okay, so it is in the Santa Cruz proposed ordinance, and it is such a good definition. It would be what I would propose the Bureau to use for their definition. Yeah.
Thank you. So I have a few questions and observation, and I would like to engage a little bit Dee Dee here in my comments since you're representing the state board today. And what I'm hearing give me pause. We're building something very, very complicated here. And I'm trying to put my thoughts together. Firstly, you know, there's an emphasis about the bad actors and pictures shown. Okay, I get that. But, you know, during Prohibition, we had the same thing. So because we had cannabis growing in California and other states being highly restricted and off, you know, and illegal, we basically developed this underground industry. So as the legalization takes place, I think that you will see less and less of these illegal activities because they can become legal. I would submit also that even today, you have good actors, okay? I am chair of the Agriculture Liaison Advisory Board in the county of San Luis Obispo, and it's a board of supervisor appointment. We had presentation from the Central Coast Cannabis Growers Association. Very organized PowerPoint presentations. And these are folks who want to do things the right way, the legal way. You know, we're talking about concerns over pesticides and there is such a thing as organic cannabis growers. That has not even been mentioned in the conversations here. So ultimately, cannabis is agriculture. That's where it starts. Now, when you dry it and you roll it and you smoke it, that's a different business. It's analogous to wine grape growing. Wine grape growing is agriculture until you start fermenting the product and then go through the same stages of various types of regulations. So I think we're sometime here, you know, missing the point that it fundamentally it's agriculture. When I hear concerns about, well, we need the water rights division to be involved because of, utilizing direct pumping from streams, etc. Well, guess what? We have the same regulations in agriculture. Example, Russian River, the stranded fish concerns that took place in dewatering for frost protection. These have been addressed. That applied with grape growing. So what I'm suggesting is where there are efforts here to almost duplicate what is already existing is not necessary. The other point I would like to make is, as chair, I participate every month to our chair calls with Tom Howard and council. And increasingly, we talk about one-stop shopping, working smarter, being a more leaning organization. And I see us building something very, very complex here, where there is a need, I believe, for a lot closer collaborative and homogeneous effort between state board and regions. The fact of the matter is that there are discussions right now with various ag commodities to have conjunctive use of their ag land to also have cannabis growing along with other commodities. So the point made by, you know, my colleague, Mr. Johnston, I think was a good one. Well, what about if you have, you know, two ags? We already have, for example, in our ag order, tier one, tier two, three. So I think there's a need for a bit of time of reflection here. It's like I realize the train left the station, but I don't think it is on the right track as it left the station. So I think this gives me a pause. The other point that I wanted to make also is when we're looking at the regulations, we need to develop regulations that will be sustainable in a sense after 2018, because as this industry goes through evolution, you know, I think there's going to be some adjustment taking place. So trying to build today, I don't think is the correct approach. You know, there's discussions amongst well-qualified cannabis growers about also setting up their own certification programs for sustainability. And, you know, I think, unfortunately, often, you know, cannabis is portrayed as, some bad actors, but these are folks who are involved in genetics, you know, looking at, improving drought-resistant plant growing. And one thing that was not even discussed today is the dry farming. Guess what? You can dry farm cannabis. And, of course, it depends where you are. You can't grow necessarily cannabis, you know, where you have 6 inches of rain per year. But in coastal areas where you have high rainfall, yes, you can. Not any different than some other crops that you can dry farm. So what I'm suggesting is really to have our state, I encourage our state board, and that's the message I would like to convey, to work more closely with regions right now and collaboratively, you know, work in crafting something that will be homogeneous between state and region, and we don't end up with having a state board regulation, region 3 regulation, and overlaps. And, you know, we hear regularly from our constituents, what a board, you're dysfunctional. You guys don't behave as one agency. You know, we already have a situation where for the same permittee, you have to go to the fourth floor at the EPA building in Sacramento for one permit, and you got to go to the sixth floor for another permit. You know, I'm not a cannabis grower, okay? So, you know, I'm not coming here with prejudice. I'm coming here from my view that it really, really, it's actually more sausage-like than what I had heard earlier on. So that's basically, you know, my suggestion is develop, a closer committee between state board and the regions. And you can have, you know, it can be on a voluntary basis. So say, okay, whichever regions you want to dedicate staff time, and meet, and I suggest meeting face-to-face as much as possible, but also a conference call, and try to work together here, or we're going to end up with a very disjointed set of regulations. So anyway, that's my input. And I also, you know, we'd like to, since we do have staff dedicated now to cannabis, which, by the way, VRCD is missing you. It's a little side note. I would like to see, you know, a little closer participation. And then as chair, when we have our weekly meetings, you know, give me a little update on how we're progressing. So, you know, I would appreciate, Didi, if you can relay this message to Tom as well. This is strictly me speaking, you know, and I'm not speaking on behalf of my colleagues, but I think you heard from my colleagues here on the board, you know, that, you know, there's quite a few questions that we're asking ourselves on where this is going. So thank you for hearing me. So, any other common question on this item?
I think
they
were ready to read the definition.
Okay.
It's so good.
And Well, if you say so.
Indoor or indoors means any area that is contained within a fully enclosed and secured permanent structure that contains fixed exterior walls and a roof that is not open to or accessible by the public without authorization by the licensee. Structures of a temporary or non-secure nature, including but not limited to movable greenhouses, tents, and hoop houses, are not considered indoor or indoors for the purposes of this definition. And that's consistent with what we have been doing as well. We regulate hoop houses and greenhouses and tent structures under the outdoor cultivation.
County?
As proposed, yes.
Oh, it's as proposed. Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
All right, so thank you very much, you know, for your presentations. And I have a question. Pardon me?
Do you have any comment cards for this item?
No, not for this item.